broadcasting on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
Making contact.
You're listening to Making Contact. I'm Lucy Kane. 240,000 people in this country are experiencing unsheltered homelessness. That means they're sleeping in places not meant for human habitation, like outside or in vehicles. Many of them end up on the streets in cities, and there they face harassment and sweeps. That's when encampments are broken up and people forced to leave. I used to report on encampment sweeps when I worked at a local radio station in the San Francisco Bay Area, and they were horrible every single time. I've spoken to dozens of people over the years, people who told me they sometimes had basically no warning that they had to leave.
Yeah, they came and woke me up, said I had like 10 minutes, 15 minutes to basically grab what little I had, you know, whatever I could in time before they came.
I've heard stories about people getting their things taken or destroyed.
There was a lady there who is a musician. They did that. They crushed her violin. They crushed her drum set. People lost bikes. One lady lost all her uniforms for work and then lost her job.
Sweeps like this are cruel, and they can be really traumatizing. Imagine getting woken up and told you have to leave, but not having anywhere to go. And then imagine that happens to you over and over again. That is the reality for some people, and they're not just losing belongings and important documents. Often, they're also losing community. Folks in many encampments look out for each other, and losing those relationships means starting from scratch, only this time, they're often alone. We're looking at this issue today because the Supreme Court recently made a decision in a case called Grants Pass v. Johnson that's going to have a major, major impact on how local governments deal with homelessness. The question was whether the anti-camping ordinances of the city of Grants Pass violated the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. Here's lawyer for respondents Kelsey Brown Corcoran speaking during oral arguments.
The city interprets and applies the ordinances to permit non-homeless people to rest on blankets in public parks, while a homeless person who does the same thing breaks the law. The ordinances, by design, make it physically impossible for homeless people to live in Grants Pass without facing endless fines and jail time.
Ultimately, the court ruled that cities can fine and jail unhoused people for sleeping in public, even if they don't have anywhere else to go. It's a huge blow to the rights of people experiencing homelessness, and it opens the door for increased sweeps.
And the Supreme Court said, you know, the protections under the Eighth Amendment against cruel and unusual punishment don't apply to unhoused people, don't apply in these circumstances. And so they let the dogs out.
That's Paul Bowden, the executive director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project, or RAP, which is based in San Francisco and which submitted an amicus brief in the Supreme Court case. Paul is formerly unhoused and has spent decades fighting for the rights of unhoused people and trying to stop sweeps. So how is this Supreme Court decision likely going to impact folks who are living on the streets?
Oh, it already has. I mean, Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, issued an executive order.
The executive order directs state agencies to clear encampments on state land and urges cities to do the same. Governor Newsom also threatened to pull state funding from cities and counties for not doing so. And in early August, he went to an encampment in Los Angeles to personally participate in a sweep.
We're done with the excuses. And the last big excuse was, well, the courts are saying we can't do anything. Well, that's no longer the case. So we had a simple executive order. Do your job. There's no more excuses.
It's already turned the volume up, the campaigns of local and state governments to aggressively address the issue of homelessness based on a concept that says, if we see it, we have a homeless problem. If we don't see it, we don't have a homeless problem.
In San Francisco, Mayor London Breed launched very aggressive sweeps following the Supreme Court decision, and other cities are following suit. This is going to further criminalize homelessness and poverty.
People end up being incarcerated or cited with tickets that then become bench warrants because clearly they can't afford to pay the tickets or they don't show up in court. But people have ended up in this based on this really carceral approach to addressing the issue of homelessness.
The United States has a long history of trying to keep people deemed undesirable out of public spaces.
Like, that's the thing about looking at this stuff in isolation, like the Japanese American Exclusion Act, the sundown towns, and then you look at the Jim Crow laws and other laws, the Native American wiping out of whole communities. Like, you use that time, place, and manner restrictions that local governments hold so dear, where they control the environment in their community as relates to the time, place, and manner that people are out in public spaces. And they've used it in a discriminatory fashion for as long as we've been colonizing this space that we're in.
And laws that prohibit sleeping, standing, or lying in public are just a newer iteration of this long history. It's no accident that unhoused folks are disproportionately people of color, disabled people, and queer and trans people, the same communities who have been historically targeted.
I mean, it's displacement, it's relocation, it's removal. It's a very forceful, militaristic removal of the presence of people that are living in public spaces because they don't have a roof over their head.
I think it's important to remember that the wave of homelessness that we're seeing today didn't just show up from nowhere. It has its roots in the 1980s, especially in actions taken by the Reagan administration.
There were massive affordable housing cuts at the beginning of the Reagan Revolution between 1980 and 1983. Around $54 billion a year nationally that was being cut just in the public housing programs, as well as the rural programs and the Section 8 programs. It was this massive disinvestment in providing subsidies and maintenance operational fees for the development of public housing for poor people.
And that disinvestment continued. According to Paul, there are over 400,000 fewer units of public housing available today than in 1994. Instead of investing in public housing, the Reagan administration directed the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, to create emergency shelters instead, which are only meant for temporary stays.
So we didn't replenish the housing, but we did heavily increase the policing and the carceral approach to addressing the issue of homelessness once we had opened emergency shelters. You don't address the cause of why the problem that you're trying to address actually exists. Like, you're not really addressing housing. You're not really developing housing and subsidizing housing that meets the need. So you go for the cosmetic approach.
Homelessness is due to policies that we could change but don't, like the massive disinvestment in public and affordable housing Paul talked about, and other things like stagnant wages, cuts to social welfare, barriers to healthcare and education, and mass incarceration. These all contribute to homelessness. And then when you put all of that into the container of historical racism and exclusion in this country, you get what we see today. It's not just one city in Oregon. It's not even just in this country. Prioritizing the carceral and military systems shapes how America approaches the world.
The systems that created the kind of LGBT attacks that we're seeing, the attacks on reproductive rights, the attacks on unhoused community members, the incarceration rates. You look at who's in our streets, who's in our jails, who's in our prisons. It's very consistent of who is the majority of those people. And that we understand that the organizing to address this stuff, the prioritizing of the Pentagon over the Health Department of Health and Human Services or the housing and urban development programs, like, this is all connected. And our fighting for the humanity of the people in Gaza and the people that are living in the streets is the same fight. And we just need to get better and better and better at connecting those issues and bringing it under the rubric of we're fighting for human rights for all people.
That was the voice of Paul Bowden, executive director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project.
I'm just jumping in to remind you that you're listening to Making Contact. If you like today's show and want more information, or if you'd like to leave us a comment, visit us at our new website, focmedia.org. There you can access today's show and all of our prior episodes. And now, back to the show.
Now we'll turn to New York City to zoom in on the fight to legalize and protect one really important type of affordable housing, apartments in basements and cellars, many of which are unauthorized and unregulated. Up to hundreds of thousands of people live in these units, even though tenants are at risk of evictions that could lead to homelessness, and the units can lack safety protections. Up next, we have a story from a partner podcast about what happened when that turned deadly for one immigrant family, and why this issue is so urgent in the face of escalating climate change. Here is producer Stella Gu with a story brought to us by the Queens Memory Podcast.
Flash-flooding sea, states of emergency in New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania.
September 1st, 2021. On what many thought would be a normal pandemic, the remnants of Hurricane Ida swept through New York City.
The National Weather Service declared its first ever flash-flooding emergency for New York City.
Although the storm originally made landfall in New Orleans days before as a Category 4 hurricane, its strength in New York City was not well forecasted, leaving residents and officials underprepared for the destruction it would cause.
The mayor called this the biggest wake-up call that New Yorkers can get. And boy, do the people in this community know what he's talking about.
No other borough would pay a bigger price than Queens. Out of the 13 who lost their lives in New York City, 11 lived in Queens. And 10 occupied the same type of illegal apartment.
Anyone in a lower level apartment like the one here suddenly felt doomed.
Three were a family living on Park Avenue, a father, a mother, and a daughter.
Three bodies in a flooded basement inside of his apartment building were on the corner of Park Avenue.
In early news reports, the Chinese family had no name and was a mere statistic. No one knew who they were. Even within Chinese community, it would not be easy to identify them.
She told me the male victim was from Hubei, same province I was from, and asked if I knew him since I'm the president of Hubei Association. But I had no idea who that was.
Zhang Dechao, a Chinese medicine practitioner and the president of the Hubei Province Association, took it upon himself to find out.
This accident happened on September 1st, 2021. It was a 500-year storm. I wasn't aware of this until the journalist from the World Journal called me. We started to ask around from the senior center and nursing home to see if anyone knew someone his age and from Hubei. Eventually, we got to know his last name and then found out his full name, Leng Hongsheng. But we couldn't get in touch with their families. Later, through someone from Hubei, we got the number of the brother-in-law of Mr. Leng in China. At that time, my son was in China, so I asked him to make the phone call as soon as possible. We called many times, but no one picked up, because he thought it was a scam. Eventually, we contacted neighborhood committee and local police, finally got in touch with them.
It's hard to imagine today how chaotic it must have been that night when I stand in front of the once flooded house on Park Avenue. This small neighborhood is strangely situated in Casino Park. 100 years ago, no one lived here. There was a creek called Casino Creek, which later was buried. In Chippewa, Kasina means cool water.
That place is the lowest area in Flushing. It was originally a swamp, then dried out. There was even a bridge. And later, somehow, houses got built there. Every year it would be flooded whenever it rains. Later on, a park was built here, one meadowland and one wetland. It is not suitable for people to live here. But I don't know why the housing situation didn't get attention from the government. So many underserved groups live here. The drainage system should have been improved. It is questionable whether the situation there is completely following the safety code. And that's why you see so many residents here are low-income Chinese immigrants. Normally, a basement has a window above ground. But Mr. Lung's window was 2-3 feet below the ground level. You walk down a 12-step stairway to his door. That area is already the lowest in Flushing. That basement was truly the lowest of the lowest. That's why all the water went to his basement that night within a couple of minutes. Tons of water rushed to their door. They didn't stand a chance. The Lung family went to bed early. The storm happened late at night. They must have thought it was safe to stay at home. But that place flooded every year. The problem never get resolved. The reason they stuck to living there is that they had applied for affordable housing and were hopeful that they would be able to move out very soon. They waited and waited. Their turn never came.
Different types of affordable housing programs exist for low-income groups. The most common two are public buildings, which have a long waiting list, and affordable housing lotteries. Public buildings owned by the government are very limited in number. Once your application is approved, your waiting time could be 10 years or more. While the affordable housing lottery is a cooperation between the government and the commercial real estate developers, eligible applicants secure apartments based entirely on luck. Both routes to affordable housing are complicated. So once you are in for life. But for people who wait in lines for years, the lottery can feel cruel. And in Mr. Lung's case, fatal. Just like so many other immigrants who traveled thousands of miles to relocate to the U.S., Mr. Lung started his journey with hope. But he ended up without even a safe home. The ashes of Lung's family were eventually shipped to China in a volunteer cargo truck. When a tragedy like this occurs, we always wonder what we could have done to prevent it from happening. The house the Lung family lived in had 9 complaints filed against it from 2000 to 2007. 8 of them were either about the illegal conversion of basements or about the space being overcrowded with too many occupants. And the problem is twofold, in both supply and demand. Even as affordable housing units remain in short supply, people like Mr. Lung would keep applying, hoping against all hope that one day they would win the lottery. The best things in life are worth waiting for. Housing is one of those things for Chinese families. There's a saying in Chinese, "Anshen Li Ming." The home is where the soul comes to rest, on the grounds of which new life can take hold. The so-called housing security in Chinese culture is more than just an economic ideal. It's a spiritual one tied to one's sense of belonging in this world. And yet, due to the affordable housing crunch in Queens, families are forced to wait, often with no end in sight.
with Stella Gu, a producer with the Queen's Memory podcast. You just heard an excerpt from the season 3 story, Invisible Homeless. The story is also available in Mandarin. Go to queensmemory.org for more information. To learn more about basement apartments, I spoke with Aneta Sicherin. She's the executive director of Chaya Community Development Corporation, a housing and economic justice organization dedicated to serving low-income South Asians and Indo-Caribbeans in New York City. Chaya, along with other organizations, is part of the Basement Apartments Safe for Everyone, or BASE, campaign that supports a pathway to legalize and regulate these units. We just heard the story of this immigrant family who very sadly perished in their basement apartment during Hurricane Ida. Could their deaths have been prevented?
100%. And this is why we are putting so much effort into this and pushing so hard. This is a leading campaign for my organization and for many others within the housing movement here in New York City, because it's a huge risk, and these deaths shouldn't have happened, and they absolutely could have been prevented had New York City and New York State address the issue of basement apartments and basement safety.
Could you talk about the BASE campaign? What is it advocating for?
Basement apartments in New York City are a critical part of the New York City affordable housing stock. We've estimated that there's probably more than 400,000 basement units spread out across the city. And when I say across the city, I think every neighborhood, in wealthy neighborhoods, in low-income neighborhoods, they all have basement apartments. And basement apartments have been home to New Yorkers of all walks of life for as long as they've existed. Could be a young person just getting started in life. It could be a recent immigrant family. It could be an elderly parent. So the reason why the BASE campaign exists is because basement apartments, the vast majority of them, are considered unauthorized units or quote unquote illegal. Yet everybody knows that they exist and people live in them. The concern is that for a very long time now, because these units are unauthorized, homeowners would randomly get a fine or an eviction order because somebody complained that they are subletting their basement apartments. And we saw trends of this, of the city cracking down in certain neighborhoods, often as a result of some sort of xenophobia. When there was an increase of certain immigrant populations in the neighborhood, et cetera. But there was for sure an unevenness in the crackdown on basement apartments.
What happens when authorities get notified of unauthorized basement apartments?
Because this has been such an issue that happens in the shadows, there isn't official data about how this contributes to homelessness, for example, right? When there's a crackdown. I do believe that these crackdowns in certain communities definitely contribute to homelessness. What we do know is that certainly in some communities like the South Asian community, when there's a crackdown, what typically happens is that the tenant then finds another place to live with an extended family member, for example. But that's not a forever solution. In no time, those tenants are back in this particular, in the basement that they vacated or another basement. And so we haven't solved the problem here, right? By cracking down, you're only losing a unit and you're causing homeowners to suffer and potentially put them at risk for defaulting on their mortgage or just, losing critical income that they rely on.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how basement apartments allow tenants to stay in their communities or to also be around their family members?
They are so critical. You know, my family, for example, when we first arrived in this country when I was 13 years old, we stayed in a basement apartment with my aunt. And it is often the only accessible housing for low-income folks, for new arrivals, sometimes young people, sometimes older adults, to stay within a community where they feel comfortable, where they can buy foods that's familiar, where they can find jobs that are easily accessible to them. They keep communities together. They are important, and they allow people to stay together, really, right? And prevent displacement.
And at the same time, because some of these basement apartments are, as you say, unauthorized, can you describe how that makes their tenants more vulnerable?
It creates a multiplicity of problems for tenants. Because they are often done, in the shadows, right? Like not in a legal market. It puts tenants in a vulnerable position because they often don't have a lease. Those tenants who don't have a lease don't really have a legal backing to getting the help that they need as tenants, right? It also puts homeowners in a vulnerable position. Leases are important. It's a legal contract between the landlord and the tenant. And so often, because they are unauthorized, these units are rented out without a lease. The other issue is that basic safety concerns are not addressed. Homeowners are not able to update their apartments if they want to, because there isn't a structure, there isn't an infrastructure, a legal infrastructure that allows them, that provides the support that they may need to make those apartments safe. And so what the campaign is proposing is that there is a citywide program that supports homeowners in bringing those apartments up to code, that regulates them like you would regulate any other rental housing unit, and it protects both the homeowner and the tenants. And now what we've seen in Ida, right, with climate change, there is an urgency around this matter, because we saw with Ida, 11 people perished in basement apartments. You know, we feel that there is an urgency here, not just to really bring a level of dignity to basement dwellers, also give homeowners a reliable source of income that they feel good about. Until we deal with the affordable housing crisis, people will continue to live in basement apartments. We're never going to stop this issue. And so we might as well lean into it, make them safer, you know, bring them on, you know, online as part of a formal part of the affordable housing stock, and not an underground, pun intended here, right? Part of the housing stock.
Well, Annetta, thank you so much for taking the time to join me on Making Contact today.
Thank you very much.
That's Annetta Sicherin, the executive director of Chaya Community Development Corporation. And that does it for today's show. To learn more, head over to our new website, focmedia.org, where you can find more details about this episode and our archive. I'm Lucy Kang. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
Tune in to Intravenous on Wednesdays from 10 to 11 a.m. for music and talk radio about all things, all genders. Discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through an intersectional feminist lens, our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemony. Intravenous, every Wednesday morning from 10 to 11, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse, independent, yours.
your guitar feeling like?